For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
This episode of the Gegen Pressing Podcast is brought to you by BetOnline. BetOnline is your number one source for the NBA and NHL playoffs this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to your online casino and get in on game of blackjack or poker, or unwind with one of over 150 slot games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code BELIEVE, that is B-L-E-A-V, BELIEVE, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. BetOnline, the game starts here. Hallo und willkommen zu Gegenpressing, der Bundesliga-Podcast. I'm Manu Feit, he's Stefan Bienkowski. I guess, Stefan, first of all, how's it going? And second, I guess for this episode, we should rename it the Euro 24 podcast.
Yeah, I'm doing very well. And absolutely, this is our kind of preview to the competition of sorts, following on from, obviously, Germany's clash with Greece last night. And yeah, this is probably... You know, we technically finished the season, obviously, with our show in the Champions League final. Hopefully people enjoyed that. And this will probably be our only public show during the competition, unless, I guess, Germany reached the finals or something. We could probably make that one public. But yeah, we just kind of wanted to offer the show, obviously, as a preview to the competition, but also an opportunity to say to people who don't subscribe through the Substack, just let them know what we have planned for the tournament. So I think what we're going to try and do is offer up a preview episode and a review episode of every Germany game. So, you know, going, obviously starting with the Scotland game, which this episode will probably count as the preview unless something crazy happens, like, you know, Kai Havertz breaks his leg or something, touch wood, but obviously hopefully it doesn't happen, but something crazy, or, you know, Manuel Neuer decides to retire a day before the tournament or something. This episode should count as the preview episode for that game. We're not quite sure how we're going to do the review show, because we're both going to be in Munich, and you're going to be at a game, I'm going to be in a beer garden, so we'll see how that one works out. But we'll do a review of that game somehow, either with myself or one of our other guests that we routinely have on. And then, of course, we have the Hungary game on the 19th and the Switzerland game on the 23rd. So if you're interested in keeping on top of things during the Euros and you don't already subscribe to the Substack, it may be worth considering if you do kind of go to want to get your full dose of Gegenpressing during the competition. So we'll have preview shows and review shows of every game, but we'll also be doing thread chats on the Substack app with our subscribers for each game as well, which is where we jump in and chat to our subscribers. And that should be good fun because I'm almost certainly going to be drunk during the Scotland game. So I will be in there rooting for the team that no one else is rooting for in that chat.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, there might be a few Scots in there, yeah, but I'll be getting progressively drunker and probably progressively more frustrated as Germany kind of tightened their control of that game. So yeah, if any of that interests you, do consider signing up. We do a 1 month free trial as well, so you can always take out a free trial, join the competition, and see what you think of how we do things. And yeah, public service announcement over.
Yeah, and I guess our written content will start again next week too. We took a week off after Wembley, which we should say that
you will be at the games during the group stage. So Manu will be in the stadium and doing match reports from there for the Substack as well.
Yeah, so on location, it's going to be intriguing, Stefan, how that opening game is going to be with you. You and I have to say this: you and a bunch of your friends are showing up and are staying with my parents. Well, I'm trying to be professional, so that's going to be very hilarious.
Yeah, we've already convinced you, managed to really twist your arm into coming to the beer hall with us the night before the game, with what, 6 or 7 rowdy Scotsmen.
Mind you, like straight off a plane from Canada.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, lots of let's be honest, it's a very unique package of content that we offer. Very few football podcasts could offer such a realistic, grizzled, warts and all approach to a football tournament. But I think that probably sums up Gegenpressing quite well.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I have to say too that this is the second time I've kind of been doing this from a tournament. This podcast was already around in 2018 when I was covering the World Cup on location in Russia. So I'm really curious to see how this one is, Stefan, because I was living out of different hotels, FIFA hotels, which I don't think I can do that anymore. I'm too old. But at the time, it seemed like a logical, cheap place to stay in. And so I'm really looking forward to this tournament because it's going to be a very different experience because I'm basically just staying at my parents' place covering all the games in Munich.
Well, you know, it's the best way to do it sometimes. This is the thing that I think often kind of one of the biggest misunderstandings about being a football journalist, and people who have to travel a lot for work probably appreciate this, but I have a friend who's he's much more than this, but long story short, he's more or less a traveling salesman. And he and I routinely bond over how miserable we find hotel rooms. Like, you could be staying in the nicest hotel room, but after day 2 or 3, it gets pretty depressing, and you just kind of, yeah. Well, at least for me personally, I just want to go home. So it's a nice thing that you get to stay with your parents, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a huge difference, to be honest. I mean, the hotel can be super nice, but I think after a few days, you just miss like basic things. Like a fridge or like the ability to exercise, or, you know, there's just tiny things that you miss. And even if a hotel room is big, it's never the size of the place that you live in, right? So yeah, it's, I don't know, it's just different. Or just the chance to wash laundry. That is usually the thing that gets me the most, because you just see this pile of dirty laundry grow in your backpack. And then I remember this during the tournament in Russia, you start this internal debate of when do you cough up the money to get the laundry service, which is like totally overpriced. So, this is going to be a very different experience. I'm essentially staying at home, which is going to be nice. And then I'm actually really lucky, Stefan, because the next tournament is World Cup 26, which is also at home. So, it's nice. And I'm actually really intrigued about this tournament. Let's change the focus onto what we can actually expect. We have a work chat. We talked a little bit about that Germany game yesterday, right? And then, of course, there was also the game against Ukraine. Germany play you guys first, Scotland, and then Switzerland, and then Hungary. Sorry, first Hungary and then Switzerland. I actually think that those two friendlies fill me with a little bit of optimism ahead of those games, because the biggest worry I had about Germany ahead of Euro 24 wasn't their performances against big teams. It was their performances against the quote-unquote, and I don't want to be disrespectful at all, smaller teams, right? And while the first half I thought was borderline catastrophic, the fact that the result against Greece was overturned, that is something we would not have seen a year ago.
Yeah, you're right. It would have been a potential kind of banana skin, which, as you said, was almost playing out when that first goal went in for Greece in the 33rd minute, and you kind of just saw the stadium just kind of collectively groan. You saw Manuel Neuer kind of looking to the stars, cursing his luck. And I think that's actually probably a very healthy way to look at it, to be perfectly honest with you, because I completely agree with you in the sense that it probably was really good preparation for the start of the tournament, because, you know, you had, for Germany at least, going into this group stage, they've got three teams who are going to sit deep, they're going to make things really difficult for them, and they're going to try and frustrate the game and basically try to just kind of claw a point against Germany in each three games. And, you know, we've obviously seen Germany in previous tournaments where they've struggled in the group stage, to the extent that they struggled to get out of them at all, but it's also just kind of gone on to kind of almost define the tournament in each circumstance. And if Nagelsmann's team can take something from that Greece game, hopefully it will be the manner in which they can not really set up in the first place, but how they react to that adversity. Because, you know, I watched the game back this afternoon and I took a bunch of notes, which I'm happy to kind of run through as we kind of go through the game itself. But I think I probably agree with you in the sense that although I have some real issues with individual performances, I actually think the way that Nagelsmann kind of reacted at halftime and in the second half was actually really encouraging. And that's hopefully what could be the kind of defining factor for Germany at this tournament, because while they don't have the best team on paper, while they don't have the best bench on paper, you know, there's probably three or four countries that maybe have stronger squads than Germany going into this. And, you know, I'm struggling to remember a time prior to since Jogi Löw took over, really, or I guess since Jurgen Klinsmann came in, actually. You'd have to go all the way back to before that to, you know, the expectations on a German national team going into the tournament being this low. But I think the thing that Germany do have that a lot of these other nations don't have is a head coach with the pedigree that Nagelsmann has. And even in this game alone, the kind of substitution changes he made at halftime, I think, were a perfect example of that. And that could end up being Germany's kind of secret weapon, if you will, in the sense that they might not have the best start at 11, but they have a manager or a head coach who's capable of kind of tweaking his team in game. And that could prove crucial against these smaller clubs, or these smaller nations rather, who want to really frustrate Germany, because they're all three of them small nations, but I think they're all very different. I mean, I can also speak from a Scotland point of view in the sense that, you know, well, I'll get into it, I suppose. But yeah, I guess I think what I'm saying here is that I think that's probably the best way to look at how these two games played out.
Yeah, no, I mean the feedback from Germany about the Greece game has been, that the game that they played a really poor game, and I think, you know, in large stretches of that fixture, that's true. It wasn't great. It was disjointed. There was times where they were made a lot of mistakes. Greece had the ability to hit them on the counter quite a few times. You got the sense that not all players were 100% sharp yet. There's the Neuer mistake, which I think we need to get into in a moment, right? There's the fact that Ilkay Gündoğan doesn't really seem to have a place in the starting 11. Those things are all true. Having said that, those first 45 minutes were pretty much every single friendly that I've ever seen Germany play in a pre-tournament. I can't recall one pre tournament friendly that was excellent. Even the one, and I went back and I looked at all of them, right? And the one that was maybe the most convincing was the 6-1 victory over Armenia ahead of 2014. Mind you, though, they lost Marco Reus in that game, right? And that start of that game wasn't brilliant either. And the game before that in 2014, so I'm using 2014 because they won that tournament, right?
Sure.
They drew Cameroon 2-2 in a game that was anything but good. So, you know, these pre-tournament friendlies are really difficult to gauge as a kind of barometer where the team is at, because on the one hand, you need to bring in the vibe into the tournament, right? This national teams are all about vibes. Like, where are they at in terms of a team cohesion going into a tournament? What is the setup like? How do the players get along? These are very important factors for a national team going into a tournament. And interestingly enough, I thought the way the team collectively, with the players off the bench, turning around this result in the second 45 minutes and actually playing pretty decent football towards the end of the game, fill me with more optimism than previous tournaments. And I also think that the other aspect that I think is quite fascinating about this is that it just feels like there's a full unit on there, on the field, right? And Nagelsmann has really managed to get all the pieces correctly together and have a squad that really pulls together. So that, I think, is actually very different. And I compare this with, I mean, England lost to Iceland, right? Yesterday, mm-hmm. for example, which I wouldn't really pay much attention to it, but it felt like it wasn't necessarily the result that's catastrophic, but it's the vibe that has created ahead of the tournament. You know what I mean with that? Like, it's more like, oh, look, we have a positive result now, so we can carry that into the tournament. And oftentimes about these little tournaments where really you only have to navigate 7 games. You don't even have to win 7 games. You just have to navigate them.
Fair.
That can be such a big influence, such a bigger thing than actually the results itself.
Yeah, absolutely. The friendly's been very little. I was actually at a talk on Thursday night in Glasgow, a kind of pre-tournament event for Scotland fans, obviously in Scotland. And Pat Nevin was there, the former Scotland international, and he was talking about friendly internationals and his experience with them. And he was saying, look, they just don't matter. The players don't care. And he actually told a really interesting story about Duncan Ferguson, the former Everton striker, and it was actually his first game for Scotland was during a friendly ahead of a tournament. And, you know, he came on as the striker, and anyone who remembers Duncan Ferguson remembers big, powerful guy, like, you know, like a Miroslav Klose from the Scottish borders. And every ball got hit up to him, and he just watched it. He didn't run after. He didn't chase any ball down or any balls down. He didn't, you know, make any big tackles. He wasn't making any interceptions. And, you know, everyone's kind of looking around thinking, wow, this guy must be injured because this is his first game for his nation and he's not even trying. And at full time, the head coach, Craig Brown, turned to him and said, what's the matter, son? Are you injured? He's like, no, it's a friendly. Why would I bother? You know, and that's the extent to how much footballers just do not give a damn about friendly internationals. It could be their debut for their national team, and some of them won't even bother. So it's a dress rehearsal. It's a way for the guys to kind of get out and run around. Another interesting point that Pat Evan made that I thought was actually something that's often overlooked is that in this day and age where footballers play so much football, in some circumstances, you might be better just not even having pre-tournament friendlies and just giving the guys like an extra week off, because to be perfectly honest with you, I thought some of those players last night actually quite tired and could have maybe used an extra few days off. But yeah, the games themselves don't mean much. I'm still quite intrigued to go through it because there are some players I do have some question marks over tactically and speaking and things like that, especially going into these kind of three really kind of frustrating matches that Germany will likely have in the group stage. But yeah, the results don't matter, but it was still an opportunity for some players to kind of show what they can or can't do. And I did kind of take some conclusions from that.
Yeah. All right, let's do that. Let's look at this team, because it was the the starting 11, I think, is Nagelsmann's preferred starting 11. We're not sure it is the best starting 11, Stefan, but I am pretty sure that is the team that is going to walk on the pitch on June 14th at 9 p.m. Munich time. I think that the two biggest question marks for me, a lot of people in my social media feeds were complaining about Kai Havertz. Guy scored a goal. I think he did his job. I think we need to end that debate before it even begins. Kai Havertz will start as a number nine, and that's the right position for him in this setup. I actually think, you know, it works quite well. He actually scored two, right? One of them was offside. So I want to end that debate before it even begins. But right behind him, Captain Ilkay Gundogan. We've talked about this before. He just seems out of place there. And the more I watch this team, the more I think he looks out of place. And I wonder if Leroy Sané, he's not 100% fit yet. They're kind of nursing him to health ahead of the tournament and probably throughout the group stages. I do wonder if Ilkay gets replaced by Leroy Sané at some point.
Yeah, that was probably my main concern watching the game, aside from the goalkeeping situation, which we can get into at some point. But I actually was quite concerned by Gundogan going into the previous round of games against France and the Netherlands, I believe it was, watching those games. And he just looks quite slow. He doesn't look like the same kind of, you know, tenacious. I mean, I think Gundogan at his absolute best was a player who could marry tenacity and kind of defensive work off the ball with, you know, remarkable technique on the ball. So he was this kind of perfect box-to-box player who, in some teams he could be the playmaker, and in some teams he could be the kind of water carrier. And I just kind of feel at this age, he's a bit of neither, to be perfectly honest with you. I think the only thing he really did in the game was actually, he took the ball and turned with it and then kind of laid it off to Leroy Sané before Sané set it up for Havertz for the goal. So he did do something in it, but I just felt throughout the match, I mean, the thing I jotted down after the game was he was just too quiet. He's far too quiet. And unfortunately for these friendly matches, they don't really, the stats companies don't like log them like they do a normal game. So usually I would have went on Who Scored or something like that to check how many touches per game or touches he would have got in the game, but I suspect he probably touched the ball once or twice in the first half, you know, to that extent. And I did kind of watch that game, and the thing that really stood out to me in the first 20 minutes was just how poor Germany's passing was from defence to midfield. You know, I thought Rudiger was really sloppy on the ball. I thought Andrić was really sloppy on the ball. And then I thought Kimmich was quite sloppy in the ball as well. But the thing that really stood out to me was that no one seemed capable of finding Gundogan in that kind of final third. It often had to go out to Wirtz or Musiala out wide, who at that point looked quite isolated, or Havertz was obviously trying to make himself available. I thought Havertz did a good job as well, by the way. I should say that. I completely agree. I actually thought he was probably one of Germany's best players last night, to be honest with you, which I guess just goes to show how subjective watching a football game can be. But yeah, I'm really concerned about Gundogan, and I kind of, like I said in our group chat, or maybe I even said it on recent podcasts, that it feels to me like Nagelsmann's kind of cornered himself by keeping him as the captain. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Hansi Flick obviously gave him the captaincy when Toni Kroos stepped away from the national team, and Nagelsmann had a perfect opportunity to kind of come in and say, you know, I'm the new guy, I want to give it to someone else. And, you know, there's a whole list of players that he could have turned to, whether it's, you know, Antonio Rudiger, or maybe even go someone younger like Wirtz or Musiala or Havertz or someone, I don't know. But the fact that he gave it to Gundogan almost suggests he has to stick with Gundogan there. And while I can appreciate that might be a smart move in the games in the latter stages of the competition, when he's, you know, they're perhaps playing a France or Netherlands and Germany have to be a little more defensive and slower on the ball, I thought in a game like this he was completely wasted. He just took up an extra space. He wasn't quick enough in transition. And I also found that Germany were extremely open whenever Greece managed to kind of break the press and kind of counterattack. And, you know, I made a joke actually before, I think it was during the week, that Bild or someone tweeted out the predicted lineup, and it was more or less spot on with, you know, Robert Andrejc and Gundogan and Toni Kroos. And I just said that midfield trio's about 400 years old. And at times it looked 400 years old. I thought Toni Kroos was probably the only one out of the three of them I actually thought had a good game. And I thought Germany only really started to look like a really proper team that dominated the game when, you know, Pascal Gross came on. I appreciate that Pascal Gross isn't much younger than the rest of them, but it just felt to me like that midfield trio just didn't work at all.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It was actually Gündogan became captain under Flick when Manuel Neuer was out injured and just kind of kept the captaincy, right? Neuer was the captain previously. I think that when you reactivate Toni Kroos, you should have given him the captaincy. And I say that to you. It feels like this is Gündogan may be wearing the armband, and there's all sorts of cultural, historic, political significance to that. And you know, when I was in Germany, I'm only briefly home, right, for 10 days, and I'm going straight back to Germany in a few days for the tournament. But when I was there in May and June, early June, to cover all those other games and Google the Champions League and all that stuff, I noticed that Ilkay Gundogan was used a lot to advertise the Euros. And I think there is some, we all know Germany's history with migrant workers and the large Turkish community, right? I don't want to say that's why he's a convenient political figurehead, but I do think that plays a little bit of a role here. And I don't want to diminish him personally, because he feels like a very stately figure in a lot of ways. You know, when you see him off the field, he's from a very well-educated family, right? I think his brother is a mathematics professor at a big university in Germany. His family is very well off too. So, you know, he has that multicultural background, but he also carries himself almost like a politician. And I think that plays a really big role here. And so I don't want to diminish him as a person, because I think he's actually one of the smartest people on that field. And, you know, he is a brilliant football player and always was. It's the setup, though, when Toni Kroos comes back, changes everything there, right? Because all of a sudden they're not the same player by any means, but they have some of the same tendencies in terms of holding onto the ball, the way they distribute the ball and all that sort of thing. And also I feel when Toni Kroos walks away from football at the end of this tournament, he will be the most decorated German player in history. And when we look back, he may actually become the sort of figure that Franz Beckenbauer was. I don't say this lightly, because it's true, right? He won the Champions League 6 times. That is an incredible amount of trophies. We were there when he did it, Stefan. And so, you know, when the dust settles on his career, especially if this Euros is a success, he will be up there with Franz Beckenbauer and Lothar Matthäus, period. And I think when you made that decision to bring him back, I think he should have also been given the armband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it wouldn't have really mattered if Gundogan lost it, because there's a new head coach coming in, he gets to pick his own captain. And it's all much of a muchness to a large extent. The only issue is that having the captaincy gives an extra kind of, well, not extra defense or protection from being dropped, but it means that if he is dropped, it becomes a thing. And as opposed to just saying, you know, we're rotating the squad or we've got a lot of midfield options. Interestingly enough, watching that Greece game, I was struck by how kind of dysfunctional that midfield was in terms of its passing. You know, obviously Robert Andrejc's had a great season for Leverkusen, but he's such a fascinating player because he's obviously so good at what he does for Leverkusen. But in this Germany team, I felt like he looked a little bit lost You know, for example, like there was a chance that Paris had in the 63rd minute, when they kind of counterattacked, and in Germany, I think Jonathan Tah made a really great interception, stopped the ball, and then Robert Andrich picked up the loose ball, and he kind of turned and just kind of passed it immediately to Rudiger, who was already running back to goal because it'd been a German corner beforehand. Rudiger then lost the ball, and then Greece had another chance where Neuer was forced to make a save. And there was a few opportunities in the first half as well where I just felt to me like the defense and that midfield were making just really strange passes to players that were extremely, you know, uncomfortable with taking it. For example, in the lead up to the goal for Greece, and, you know, Manuel Neuer's kind of mistake will obviously cover up for all this, but if you actually watch the way that it kind of worked out, it all came about from Jonathan Tah passing the ball to Musiala deep in their own half when he already had a man closing him down, and, you know, Musiala just struggles to fend him off, and then Greece mistake him and Greece take the ball off him and eventually goes in through a mistake from Neuer. And fascinating thing is that as good as some of those Greek players were, they're not a good team. And even just to compare them to Scotland, like, I thought the Greece midfield was exceptionally average, but when they play Scotland, they're going to come up against Scott McTominay and John McGinn, who are both very physical players who are used to kind of getting stuck in and closing down players. Cal McGregor, who's a very smart player, defensive player, intercepting the ball. And Ryan Christie, who's also done very well at Bournemouth in his kind of deep line role, but he's also a very kind of physical, very energetic player. So, you know, I felt like even against a very average Greece team, that midfield trio really struggled to dominate it, which I found bizarre. And the weird thing is that the other issue I found as well is that in the second half, when Nagelsmann decided to bring on Benjamin Henrichs at right back and then David Rahm at left back, the two of them pushing forward and opening up the pitch to make it wider, Germany suddenly started playing a lot better because it meant that there was more space for the likes of Musiala, Leroy Sané, Havertz to run into. And, you know, I think part of that's down to the fact that Mittelstadt's obviously, you know, still coming to terms with being a German national team player, doesn't want to make mistakes. He was more concerned maybe with not letting players in behind him. But I found Joshua Kimmich just completely useless in an attacking sense. He's not Philipp Lahm. He's not going to be that fullback who bombs down the wing and swings it across. He's obviously far more interested in playing safe balls and keeping the ball. And I kind of feel like if that's the way that Kimmich's going to play at right back, maybe we're as well just sticking him alongside Toni Kroos in the middle of the park instead of a Robert Andrich, if it means that Germany have two smart passers on the ball who can actually keep it and maybe try and dominate in the middle of the pitch. Because Kimmich at right back and then Robert Andrich and Gundogan in the middle feels like you're kind of you're almost having to sacrifice two or three positions where you could just kind of shuffle it around a bit, drop Gundogan or drop Andrich, bring Henrichs in, and the team maybe just has a better balance to it.
This episode of the Gegenpressing Podcast is brought to you by BetOnline. BetOnline is your number one source for the NBA and NHL playoffs this season. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to your online casino and get in on game of blackjack or poker, or unwind with one of over 150 slot games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Don't forget to use the promo code BELIEVE, that is BLEAV, BELIEVE, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online. The game starts here. Yeah, I thought that Pascal Gross, not only because of his goal, but also the way he balanced the midfield made a huge difference.
What a goal.
Yeah, what a goal. I mean,
first goal for Germany, good way to start.
There was also that Benjamin Henry strike, which I was jokingly saying to Dan Wyden, who was at the game, right, friend of the show, whether he felt the ball hitting the crossbar all the way up to the press stand. I mean, I don't know, that was quite a strike. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the Kroos-Andrich partnership, you need that for the bigger teams. I think you saw the value in that against France and Netherlands, right? Andrich is someone who, when you have, and that actually makes me wonder if that's actually someone who you need for Scotland, right? Because he is someone who, when Wirtz and Musiala get tackled by maybe some of the bigger guys, who can just step in and like, hey, not on my watch, right?
Yeah.
He does give that enforcer. He looks almost like a good old enforcer. He reminds me a lot of Jens Jeremies from back in the 90s and early 2000s, just a player who you don't want to fool around with. And I think that is a really important role he plays in that. The question is, do you need that in a game that you're going to dominate possession in?
Like
they did against Greece and will most likely against Switzerland and Hungary in a different way than against Scotland, right? I think what that the Greek side offered, and I thought that was really interesting. Solis, again, really impressed me. I already thought he was very impressive doing the first leg of the relegation playoffs in the Bundesliga. We talked about that, right, on the show. What these players offered was these fast transitions that Germany will have to operate with, right? We talked so much about that defensive high line that Germany are playing with, which is why Mats Hummels isn't in this team, because they will have to deal with teams trying to hit them on the counter attack, and that's why Jonathan Tah and Antonio Rüdiger are starting, because they both have the ability and the speed to deal with that. And I actually, you know what, while it looked dangerous at times, I actually thought that Germany dealt with that quite well, with the, you know, the fact that Greece tried to hit them in transition and everyone kind of held their breath every time it happened. But at the end of the day, the only goal that Germany conceded was, and I think you're quite right pointing out all the mistakes that happened before Neuer dropped the ball, because that's important, because that all shouldn't happen either. But it wasn't really on a counter-attack. So, you know, at the end of the day, actually that defensive line held up quite well.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I actually thought that Jonathan Tah was probably the better of the two central defenders.
Yeah. Rüdiger's
an interesting one, because, you know, he's just won the Champions League. He's, you know, he's Real Madrid's most reliable central defender. But I do feel like, I felt at times in this Greece game that he looked extremely uncomfortable on and off the ball, actually. And I actually thought Germany looked better with Nico Schlotterbeck when he came on. And, you know, Germany were able to kind of, you know, play with, obviously came on for Rüdiger, and then, you know, Schlotterbeck and Tah were able to kind of play quite well. I thought at numerous times Tah was the guy who was kind of mopping up those counterattacks, and he did that very well. He's obviously got that pace to do that. So, you know, that's a good thing to have, and he's still kind of taking that form that he's shown for Leverkusen into the tournament. But yeah, it's an interesting one, because I just don't know. Obviously, and this goes back to like the midfield conundrum we have, where it's do you stick with the more defensive player, or do you go for the player who's maybe better technically in these kind of three group stage games? And I mean, I'm obviously talking theoretically here, because we know that that Nagelsmann's not going to make any big changes going into the tournament. But if it was me, I think I'd probably be quite tempted to actually drop Rüdiger in favor of Tah and Schlotterbeck, just because. Yeah, I know, and I can
that's
hear,
a big
like,
cough.
And I know, like, I can hear spines tingling up and down the German nation as I say that, but I know, I appreciate that the thought of Schlotterbeck and Jonathan Tah being Germany's first choice centre backs 12 months ago would have terrified any German fan. But, you know, Schlotterbeck's had a good end to the season. I thought he did really well in the Champions League. He's definitely beginning to kind of show the player that he once promised to be before he joined Dortmund. And Tah's obviously had a great season, and I guess it depends what you want your central defenders there to do in these kind of games. And I just think Rüdiger lacked the composure, the passing, the off-the-ball stuff that allowed Germany to kind of dominate possession and get into rhythm against Greece and dominate the game. At no point did it really feel like Germany were dominating the match until maybe 20 minutes before full-time, where Nagelsmann made his changes, but also probably where Greece began to tire quite a lot. So, you know, I guess the point I'm making here is that, you know, from, and I guess I do have a unique situation where I can talk about this as a fan of one of the opposing teams. You know, if I'm a Scotland fan and I'm expecting Germany to try and I'm thinking, well, I need to think of, I'm hoping that Scotland can disrupt Germany's game enough so that they don't feel composed, so they don't feel like they can dominate the game. I'd probably be more concerned if it did start with Tah and Schlotterbeck than I would if it had been Tah and Rüdiger. And equally in midfield, I'd actually feel a lot more comfortable seeing Andrik in there and Gundogan as opposed to, say, Kimmich and Kroos and then Leroy Sané in the number 10 position, because one of those setups is a team that you'd probably put out against France in the semi-finals, and one of them's a setup where you're like, right, we're going to have 70% of the ball in this game and we're going to have to thread a needle to find that goal that we need. And I just don't think it's much easier when you have those more technical players on the pitch.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I actually think you might be right. I don't think, you know, that is actually a really good point that you're making too, though. I don't think there's going to be many changes at this stage. Although it is Julian Nagelsmann. He might surprise us and make a couple changes ahead of the Scotland game. But yeah, I think so much has been made of the fact that he wanted to get that squad chemistry going right as much as possible and then tweak along on the fly. So I reckon the changes that you're going to see are going to be made in game rather than ahead of game, depending on the situation, which just brings us back to the top of the show, where you pointed out quite well that Germany's biggest weapon might actually be on the bench, and it's the head coach and assistant coach Thomas Müller, apparently. There was a really interesting picture of the two of them discussing different situations, and I actually think that's one of the reasons Thomas Müller's in the squad, despite his limited playing role, that, you know, he can offer a lot of insight. So a little bit of a different role for him in this tournament. But yeah, I think a lot of the changes that you will see with Germany will be on the fly in game and not ahead of game. And that includes the goalkeeping position, which is the thing that we need to talk about. There is a discussion now, right? Nagelsmann doesn't want to have one. He very quickly ended it post-game when he was asked about Manuel Neuer. He didn't even want to entertain it. It's a very difficult one because that game highlighted why Neuer should be in goal, and it also highlighted why he shouldn't be in goal. And unfortunately, the games where he's been at his best and at his worst within 90 minutes, it has become more frequent. There was a moment at the Ukraine game where he made a mistake that didn't lead to a goal. There was that goal against Greece that is 100% his. You know, this is an easy shot to stop. It needs to go into the body and stay there. It can't bounce off you. That's unforgivable. There was that goal against Hoffenheim. Remember that in the Bundesliga? And there was also, of course, the one against Real Madrid that did cost Bayern Munich the final. And so this increased amount of mistakes, together with these absolute moments of brilliance. There was one where he made that double save against Greece, where I thought, wow, this is why he's in goal, because he still has this ability to be almost cat-like, right? And it's a really difficult one, Stefan, because dropping him now seems almost impossible in terms of what sort of debate it's going to create. But maybe dropping him is also the right decision because it could cost you later in the tournament.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating situation for Nagelsmann to be in, because we talk about him as the kind of keen tactician and how, you know, one of Germany's kind of secret weapons might be the way that he can tinker with teams in mid-game. But it does kind of feel almost like he is still trying to wrestle with the kind of balance between him being this kind of master tactician who makes changes and doesn't let opposition second guess him, but also the expectation of being a national team head coach and sticking with proven stars. You know, we've talked about his reluctance to drop Gundogan, We've talked about, you know, maybe his reluctance to drop Kimmich entirely and kind of shoehorn him in at right back, where there's a perfectly good right back in our squad in Benjamin Henrichs, who Tuchel Nagelsmann knows very well and got, you know, and knows he can perform at the top level. You know, if I'm not mistaken, Benjamin Henrichs has played, you know, the semi-finals of the Champions League under Julian Nagelsmann and did very well for Leipzig. So he's got a very good right back there, but for some reason is sticking with Kimmich there because he has to kind of keep all these plates spinning. But of course, the big one's Manuel Neuer. And I was just kind of, as you were talking there, I was kind of looking through Kicker's coverage of the game, and it is all focused on, you know, the questions after the game about Manuel Neuer. And it's a very odd situation because I said, you know, when we got them, because the problem is that the kind of context of this game was based around the news prior to the match that Alexander Nubel had been dropped from the squad, and the reaction to that kind of built the kind of preamble to this game. And I must admit, I feel like that's a very odd decision to make because, in my opinion, he's probably the second best goalkeeper in that Germany squad, or he was before he got dropped out. You know, Ter Stegen was probably the first choice one. And then, of course, Nubel, and then between Baumann and Manuel Neuer, it's probably up for debate. But the problem is that you either have Manuel Neuer as your first choice goalkeeper or you don't have him in the squad at all. You can't have Manuel Neuer as your third choice goalkeeper, for example. So it means that Germany is very, you know, or Nagelsmann again has put himself in this very bizarre situation where he's kind of pinned his colours to the mast and said Manuel Neuer is my number one, and you know, that's that. Where I feel like Julian Nagelsmann, the RB Leipzig head coach, wouldn't have allowed himself to be forced into making that decision or forced into committing himself to that. And, you know, we were saying, I mean, I think we're both in agreement here that Ter Stegen's probably the best goalkeeper in this German squad. And, you know, Alexander Nubel's a perfectly good backup in that regard. And, of course, yeah, Baumann can be in there as a kind of number three. And I think you were saying as well, he's probably got a very good kind of dynamic with the squad and things like that. So that works. But, and, you know, there's obviously the whole aspect of, if Manuel Neuer is sitting on the bench in every game in this tournament, it adds almost extra pressure on the goalkeeper between the posts, because every time the spotlight is on one of those goalkeepers, everyone's going to say, well, why isn't Manuel Neuer playing? So you almost have to make that decision to either have Manuel Neuer as your number one or not have him in the squad at all. And Nagelsmann's obviously gone for the idea of sticking by Neuer, more or less on reputation at this point, because as you said, he came back, surprised a lot of people, myself included, with the way he was able to return, but he has had big problems, and that kind of fumble we saw against Greece was almost, you know, a like for like a reprisal of what happened against Real Madrid in the Champions League. And the thing that really intrigues me about it is I actually watched the replay back in slow motion, and they had a great shot of it from basically where the player hit the shot. So you're watching Neuer kind of get down to it, and I was watching the ball bounce, and I was expecting it to take an unexpected bounce just before it got to him. And then obviously you could say, well, there's not much a goalkeeper can do there if it takes an unexpected bounce, but it was quite the opposite. It was extremely slow, or not extremely slow, but it was extremely normal shot, and Neuer, I suspect, had almost already moved on to the next thought in his head. He's like, I'm going to get this ball, and I'm looking up, I'm going to pass it to, you know, David Rahm or not David Rahm at that point, but Mittelstadt on the left or whatever else. And actually that troubles me more than him missing a big save, because the big save he made in the first half, that's just pure instinct. You know, that's just something that he would do with his eyes closed. It's been trained into him. He's done it 10,000 times, and he knows in that situation, you put your head, you get down, you save the shot, you stick a hand up, and sometimes you save them. And that's just him going through the motions. But the mistake was almost worse, because that's basically complacency, or that's him not thinking things through, or maybe just being a little sloppier than he would have been 5 or 6 years ago. And that's kind of what concerns me. And I think that's the part of, that's the thing that's kind of creeped into his game that's made him no longer the Manuel Neuer that he once was. So I don't know. It's a fascinating situation because I do feel like Nagelsmann is having to kind of wrestle with these things. And it's a whole new thing for him because he's never been, you know, an international manager before.
Yeah. The Süddeutsche Zeitung headline was streng verboten when it, goalkeeper discussion. I don't think I need to translate streng verboten. Strictly forbidden, I guess, is the best way to say it. But yeah, it's a really difficult one because, you know, the decision to start Neuer was made in, ahead of the March friendlies, and then Neuer actually got injured, right, ahead of those friendlies, and Ter Stegen played and they won both those games. And it's really, I think that put them into a position where they couldn't really go back on it. I guess we just have to hope it works out and that he has his wobbles now figured out, because it's been a lot of wobbles lately. And I had someone say to me on Twitter that, look, Ter Stegen also makes mistakes, but not in the frequency Neuer's lately made. And yeah, I think, you know, there was that moment against the Netherlands, right, with Mittelstadt and Ter Stegen. But from what you can gather by Ter Stegen at Barcelona, he's been extremely solid. And so I don't know. It's a really difficult one. And it's a really difficult one to navigate. It's sort of reminiscent a little bit of what happened ahead of 2006 with Oliver Kahn and Jens Lehmann, right? And Jürgen Klinsmann made the really difficult decision to start Jens Lehmann ahead of Oliver Kahn. And, you know, and the decision then was made because Jens Lehmann was the better football player, right? Jürgen Klinsmann wanted a goalkeeper who could play with the ball on his feet. And maybe that's ultimately why Nagelsmann is sticking with Neuer. Almost making the reverse decision of what Klinsmann made then, right? But now Neuer is slightly better with the ball on his feet. And if that is why he makes that decision, I guess that decision-making outweighs the risks of Neuer making a mistake that could cost Germany the tournament. That is ultimately, I think, what it comes down to, Stefan.
Yeah, and it's a fair point. And actually, at one point in the game, I believe it was in like the 17th minute after a really poor start in which, as I mentioned earlier in the show, Germany were really struggling to pass it out of defence. Nagelsmann actually pulled Neuer over to the side of the pitch when something was happening. I think one of the Greek players was down injured. And he basically was saying to him, you need to do this, you need to do this with your passing. And you could see he was pointing to him to say where his passing was. So, you know, there's no doubt that Neuer still has that remarkable ability with the ball at his feet. And I guess in particular games, that may prove more important than just his sheer shot-stopping ability. And look, I guess at the end of the day, you could argue that him making this huge blunder in the final friendly match before a tournament is the best time to do it. You know, it's better that than 5 minutes into the Scotland game. Of course, I would love that. But, you know, in fact, let's say 5 minutes into the Hungary game. In fact, no, I don't want him to do it in any game except Scotland game. Yeah, Scotland, do it against Scotland. But yeah, so it's obviously, it might work out as a positive form, but, and look, I mean, I think the difference between Manuel Neuer in goals and Ter Stegen in goals is, you know, 2-3% difference or something. So that in itself probably isn't going to decide Germany's success this tournament unless we get another kind of blunder like that. And at that point, then, you know, there's just not much you can do about it. And you just have to hold your hands up and say, it was a risk that we took and it didn't work out. So we get on, we move on. But I'm just intrigued by the fact that, you know, this is Nagelsmann's team. There has been some big changes from the one that was in place under Hansi Flick not that long ago, and we've seen some, obviously a lot of new faces come in. But I guess I'm just still quite intrigued by the fact that there still are a lot of kind of faces from the old era. You know, this is the point I made before the game. I was like, considering how many sacred cows that Nagelsmann has slaughtered, in the sense, you know, he's dropped Mats Hummels, he's dropped Leon Goretzka, arguably dropped Thomas Müller. I know he kind of brought him back, but he's not starting, obviously. Kimmich has been kind of shunned to right back. It's just quite intriguing that Manuel Neuer is the one he wasn't willing to kind of continue that with and Gundogan as well. And you know, I guess we'll just have to see how this plays out in the tournament, and it might work out well, and Germany might have the perfect balance between youth and experience, and maybe that's exactly what Nagelsmann's kind of relying on here. But it just goes to show how tricky, I suppose, it is in putting these teams together for a tournament like this.
Yeah, no, that's just it, right? I mean, and interestingly enough, I think Germany isn't the only country that has these discussions. You look at England, you look at France, you look at Spain. I think every single one of those teams are going into this tournament with similar discussions. And my experience from covering tournaments, both good and bad, is that at the end of the day, it really doesn't come down to the best 11, Stefan. It comes down to the chemistry as a whole squad. Yeah, the 2014 team in hindsight was really good. And we think of it as this brilliant German team, right, that won the World Cup. But the questions going into the tournament, when I think back, everyone doubted the defense. Everyone was worried about the number 9 position. Remember, Miroslav Klose, I think, was 38 or 37 at that tournament. So, you know, it isn't like what we are experiencing here with all those questions and doubts is new. It's quite normal. And I think it's also quite normal for all the other teams going into this tournament. It's knockout stage football pretty much from day one. And everything has to go right for you to win this thing. And the margin for error is small. And then also, it also means that sometimes, you know, it's also about just grinding out results. And that is why I actually thought this Greece performance makes me quite optimistic, even though the most of the German media seems to draw back on German angst. I actually think that was the sort of performance that wins you the tournament. As bad as it was, and I don't want to sugarcoat it, the first 45 minutes were atrocious. But I'm also old enough for Germany to grind through against Algeria in that 2014 tournament, which was some of the worst football I've ever seen a Germany team play, and they walked away with the trophy at the end of the day. So, you know, this is the weird thing about tournaments, Stefan. It's just, it's not really about the best collection of players, is it? It's really about a group of individuals coming together and finding the right chemistry and holding that chemistry together for essentially a 4-week period. And that is really the magic about it. And it's not something that there's no formula for it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also worth contextualizing this and pointing out that all the kind of top nations do have their issues. You know, we talked about England and how they're basically going into this tournament with no fit left back. France have their issues as well, which we saw when Germany played them very recently. I've seen a lot of talk actually in the French press about whether Kylian Mbappe is even fit for this tournament. So, you know, it's just the nature of international football. And I do kind of come back to this quite a lot recently, but it's football is a weak link sport in the sense that it's not usually about who has the best player on the pitch. It's about who has the worst player on the pitch and who has the biggest holes in their team. And going through that German national team, there's not too many holes. Yes, Gundogan's not the player he once was. Mario Neuer's not the player he once was. Maybe Robert Andrić isn't going to do as well as he does for Leverkusen. And maybe Rudiger's going to look a little clumsy. But they're still all top-class players. And, you know, I think perhaps looking at the way that Germany set up there, I think Nagelsmann will probably be thinking, well, as long as we can keep things relatively composed between defence and midfield, we've got one of the most talented front threes in the competition in Wirtz, Havertz and Musiala, and of course we have Leroy Sané to boot as well, who may or may not end up starting as well in a number 10 position. So there's a lot to be optimistic for Germany. I'm hoping they have a stinker on day one and then get it together against Hungary and Switzerland. But yeah, it's remarkable how much Nagelsmann has turned things around in such a short period of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's see how that first game turns out against Scotland. It's going to be a very fascinating to watch. It's going to be very different for us. This podcast is going to be divided for one day, Stefan. I think that's safe to say. And then we can reconvene on match day two. We'll be friends again.
How about this? How about we settle for a point each? That'll do me just fine.
I don't know if I can handle it, but sure. We'll see how this group stage plays out. The Euros are so weird, right? With the fact that a lot of the third place teams go through too. So yeah, a point might actually suit both sides quite well. And then of course Germany will be playing Hungary, who they had some issues with at the last Euros, and then Switzerland. A neighboring country, it's always dangerous for Germany when they play a neighboring country because they like to beat up on Germany, you know, just for all sorts of historical context. So, yeah, we'll see how it plays out. Stefan, I guess I'll see you in Munich next week.
Yes, you will. And then it'll be all fun and games going forward. The nature of the season for us has just been, it's been absolute hell, busy, nonsense, and, you know, even the Champions League final itself was exhausting. So I've only really just kind of came back around and kind of climbed out of the cave and started, you know, smelling the flowers and hearing the birds sing about a day or two ago. But the expectation and the anticipation is beginning to grow with every passing day. And I suspect by the time I hop on a train to Munich, or that flight to Munich on Thursday, I'll be raring to go.
Yeah, same. I really needed a few days after the Champions League final. I had 90 minutes of sleep before I flew back to Munich. And then, of course, I had less than 24 hours before I flew back to Canada to see the wife and the cat, and then heading back to Germany for the group stages. So, yeah, it was a much-needed break. And on that note, the Substack is now going back, you know, to what it was on the schedule. The main show, this is a main show. We actually thought we wouldn't have another main show this season, but I guess we lied. So we make this one available for everyone. And then if you want extra Euro content, sign up for Gegenpressing. There will be lots there during the tournament as well. I'll provide some articles from the games, and we'll probably have some insight on the different Bundesliga teams and what they do as well. So, yeah, if you haven't subscribed yet, this is a good time to do it. As always, this podcast is brought to you by Bet Online. And yeah, Stefan, I see you next week. And I hear you guys can hear us at some point next week too, if you are a subscriber. So think about it. And until then, auf Wiedersehen.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded, who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.